Lecture 6, Camus, The Fall, Part 2.
Clemence calls himself a judge penitent. This is a very unusual coinage, and it's worth understanding. First, notice the peculiar role of lawyers in the legal system. They're not on trial. They are not the accused, but neither are they the judges, which of course gives rise to a huge number of arguments about to what extent they should act as advocates for their clients, to what extent they should have justice as an ultimate aim. But what's interesting for the purposes of our concern here is the sense in which lawyers are right in the middle of the judicial system, and yet they're not really part of it. They're not the accused. They're not the judges. They're innocent, in a sense, in that their responsibility, their guilt and innocence is not in question, nor is it their duty to make judgments about guilt and innocence. To call yourself a judge penitent is then to really take your prior role as a lawyer and divide it and put it on each side of that polarity. On the one hand, you become the judge. On the other hand, you become the guilty, the accused. And to put them together, you judge yourself, you condemn yourself, and you're the one that's trying to somehow find redemption. When Clemence talks to us, when he seduces us with his charm and his story, what he's trying to do, as I said, is to get us to start doubting our own innocence, our own integrity. When he describes his past accomplishments, in one sense, he is getting us, rather successfully, to envy him, to admire him. At the same time, as I said, he doesn't just describe these, but he describes them as hypocrisy and fraud, so that we are tempted to view our own accomplishments as hypocrisy and fraud. Now, there's a philosophical trick here, and it's a very deep philosophical trick, one that goes back to, well, certainly to Plato and many philosophers in between, but at the same time, to assume that all of our acts are motivated by selfishness or self-interest seems to be most implausible. But the trick, of course, is one can always find a way of turning what seems to be altruistic or noble into something that's vain and selfish. And that's what Clemence does. For example, he talks about his exploits as a lawyer and how he would serve all these poor but deserving people. And he suggests that behind the nobility was a kind of almost incalculable self-righteousness. He enjoyed being innocent in the sense that he wasn't one of the accused. He enjoyed being not responsible for making the judgment. He only had to defend these people. In his life, he describes how even when he was being eloquent, when he was being generous, when he was being noble in the many senses in which he made it a point to be, it was very clear to him, or rather it's clear to him now, that what he was doing was acting out of a kind of sneaky self-interest. He was manipulating people. And what he was doing was, in effect, something that was hateful, hypocritical. He gives us an example. He helped a blind man across the street once. And when they got to the other side of the street, he politely doffed his hat. And he reflects on it and thinks, now what's the point of doffing your hat to a blind man? Obvious answer. It's not for the sake of the blind man. It's for the sake of everyone else. It's showing off that you're such a good guy that you not only helped the blind man across the street, but here you are being deferential and respectful as well. Now, I think this little incident gives us a clue about how this particular kind of argument works. Because here's an alternative description, which I would personally think is much more plausible. Here's a man who has been brought up in fairly high society. He was taught manners as a very young boy. And when you're taught manners, it certainly is not the case that whenever you are mannerly, you think to yourself, oh, this is an incident in which I should hold a door for someone, or this is an incident in which I should ask a certain kind of question, or perform a certain kind of gesture. I'm sure that Monsieur Clemence had been doffing his hat to people for many, many years, to the point where it was simply a habit. And so here on this instance, the person he was with happened to be blind, but the doffing of the hat was just a perfectly natural, virtually automatic gesture. Now, what motives were behind it? Well, I'm not sure it makes a whole lot of sense to talk about motives behind habitual behavior to begin with. But insofar as we do want to talk about motivations, why would we ascribe selfishness as the primary motive in this case? And it seems to me it's simply a misdescription. And so too, I think, when Clemence goes through his life and tells us what a hypocrite he was, how fraudulent he was, much of it I would describe is the same kind of misdescription. In fact, he behaved very much in character. His motivation was exactly as it seemed to be, to help this person, to do this deed, to be courteous and polite in this occasion. But in his description to us, or his misdescription to us, he manipulates his memories, and of course we have no way of checking, such that what comes out is a life that's filled with fraud and deceit. Now, self-deception here plays a very clear role, because we often deceive ourselves about our motives, and I can speak for myself. I often do something which seems to be a very nice thing for someone else, and with reflection I realize that I really had a kind of hidden agenda, hidden even from myself. But as Kant said, we're never in a position to know all the motives that motivate us. And I think he's quite right, as well as all the philosophers since, when he says, the truth is that why we act is often a mystery, but in many ways, it's the action itself that counts. The truth is that what Clemence does is throughout the first part of the book, that is, throughout the descriptions of his Parisian life, almost without exception, noble, unselfish, charming, sophisticated, all the things that in fact he tries to undercut in his description. Why would he do that? Well, again, I think the strategy is that on the one hand he seems to be putting himself down, but at the same time he's really undermining our conception of ourselves. Because we start thinking now, as I just did, about the generous acts we've performed that may have had a hidden motivation, or we start thinking about the selfless acts, which in fact were all about our self-esteem, or perhaps about our reputations, which of course are all to our advantage. Now there's a sense in which thinking about the motivation of your action, in fact thinking too much about what you've done, can become a real problem. I said before that The Fall is a good illustration of the kind of thesis we find in many of the existentialist writers, where consciousness, rather than being a blessing, becomes something of a disease. When I said that Clemence can't stop thinking, can't stop reflecting, part of this is he can't leave it well enough alone. He can't accept the way he lives as, that's just the way I've lived. He can't accept the way he is as, that's just the way I am. He's the very opposite here, in another way again, from Rousseau, for whom accepting his life, accepting his fate, is just built into him. It's a matter of no thinking at all. But for Clemence, it's rather thinking so much about who you are and what you've done and what it means and what it adds up to leads to nothing less than a sense of misery and guilt. And the question is, why does he do this to himself? And again, one's tempted to go back to, say, Aristotle and the conception of the tragic flaw. Because, again, if we could see the ways in which Clemence was in some way off base, or a little bit crazy, or the sense in which he really was a hypocrite in one way or another. Then we could say, ah, well, that's the way he is. But since we don't get that, it's always how much are we guilty of the same sorts of things that he claims. It was said by Socrates many years ago that the unexamined life is not worth living. But there's a point where you might want to ask, is the examined life worth living? Is it true, as Socrates, I think, rather presumptuously claimed, that people who don't stop to think about virtue and don't stop to think about who they are, who don't try to know themselves, live a distinctively inferior life? Or, looking at Clemence, we ask the question, is it possible to know yourself too well? Or does the attempt to know yourself inevitably end in a kind of self-deception and a kind of self-put-down? It goes back to Kierkegaard, who also held such a view, the view that consciousness, thinking too much, reflection, can be a disease. And as I said earlier, it certainly goes back to Dostoevsky. And here I'm thinking of his novelette called Notes from Underground, in which a very perverse character indeed gives us this picture of himself as utterly paralyzed, incapable of acting, because he thinks things through so thoroughly. And I think Clemence fits into this picture too. In one sense, you might say, he's extremely rational. But in another, more obvious sense, he's extremely irrational. He's rational in the sense that he thinks, he's articulate, he reasons, he thinks quite extensively in terms of means and ends and consequences, but he's irrational in the sense that he quite systematically seems to make himself unhappy. And it seems for most of us, without thinking about the more sophisticated notions of rationality, the ultimate irrationality, and the time when we are most likely to use that word, is when we see somebody undermining themselves, when we see somebody who is essentially making themselves miserable. The emotions with which we make ourselves miserable to us are the most irrational of emotions, whereas the emotions with which we make ourselves happy are, to us, the most rational emotions. But let's throw that into question. For example, one of the ways in which we make ourselves feel good about ourselves is the emotion of anger. There's a sense in which getting angry is a way of putting yourself on top of things, of being extremely judgmental, accusatory. At the end of The Stranger, when Meursault bursts into anger with the visiting chaplain, he ends it all by saying, "With that burst of anger, I felt as if it had swept me clean. I was ready to start life over again." A very clear indication, I think, that anger has a very therapeutic side. Not that it can't go wrong, not that it can't get us into trouble, but anger, which is often called a negative emotion, here serves a very positive purpose. It makes us feel good about ourselves. Or to take a different kind of emotion, but one might notice another one which is also on the official list of seven deadly sins, and that's the emotion of pride. There's a sense in which Clemence is proud. This is a term that has many different meanings. In fact, one of the things that I would urge you to think about is how pride has been tumbled about in the philosophy of opinion over the last 2,000 or so years. Aristotle, for instance, in his list of virtues, would say that pride, for a Greek, is absolutely essential. I think today we would say it's really all about self-respect. If you don't respect yourself, if you don't feel good about yourself, if you're not proud of your accomplishments, then there's something seriously wrong with you. But by the 8th century AD, pride was considered not only one of the seven deadly sins, it was considered the worst of them. And of course, the idea was to feel proud before God as opposed to humble is, in a way, the worst thing you can do. Today, pride has taken another tumble. You think of the groups that march under the banner of Black Pride, gay pride, and so on, pride has once again become a very positive emotion. But the pride that Clemence feels, we might well be tempted to relabel as something like arrogance, or using an ancient Greek word, chutzpah, hubris. And what we think of is the idea that what he's doing to us, and even what he's doing to himself, while he's putting himself down, while he's making himself miserable, while he's trying to make us feel miserable too, what he's really doing is expressing an enormous, arrogant pride. Now, his accusation against himself during his life in Paris is that it was all motivated by pride, here construed as a very special sense of self-interest. Pride as self-respect, pride as self-esteem, pride as thinking well of yourself. And he accuses himself of being rather outrageous. Outrageous in the fact that he never doubted his own innocence. He never doubted his own importance on the judicial scene. He never doubted his own attractiveness before women. He never doubted his general sense of presence in society. And now, from his Amsterdam bar, he looks back at all this and sees what utter vanity it was. Wounded pride, even if the wound is self-inflicted, is a very dangerous thing. Wounded pride readily becomes resentment. Resentment very readily becomes indignation. Indignation very quickly becomes a kind of self-righteousness. And what we find at the end of the novel is that Clemence, in fact, has become just as outrageously prideful as he was at the beginning. Now, some of the Christian criticism of the novel points out that the one thing Clemence never considers is the Christian view, the Christian possibility of redemption. In fact, I think it's more complicated than that, because, as I said, this novel is chock full of Christian symbolism, starting with its title, The Fall, which, without any question, alludes to the fall of Adam and Eve from Eden. Amsterdam is represented as a fairly clear depiction of hell, and the bar that he hangs at, with all of its obvious sinners, makes Clemence clearly in something like hell or purgatory. There's a sense in which his very name, John the Baptist, gives us a clue that this is something special that's going on that is not at all irrelevant to the Christian notion of guilt and redemption. And there are things all the way through the novel. For example, there's a stolen painting which is mentioned, which now is in Clemence's possession. In fact, if you wanted to pick the one thing that he actually does wrong in the entire novel, it's what we would call possession of stolen property. But the painting itself is one that at the time would have been very much in the news. It's a piece of the Van Eyck altarpiece in Belgium, and it is the panel which is called The Good Judges. And the theme of judgment, as I say, goes all the way through the novel. On the one hand, the catchphrase might be, "Judge not, that ye not be judged." But of course, that has all kinds of variations, many of them kind of wisecracks, but some of them very serious indeed. One of the wisecracks is, "Judge them before they judge you." And there's a sense in which one might see that Clemence, in his earlier life, despite his supposedly non-judgmental role as a lawyer, was in fact very judgmental, and judgmental in such a way that other people didn't have a chance to judge him back. We all find that if you can judge somebody as being insignificant first, then what they say about you matters so much less. Or more important, "Judge not that you not be judged." But that doesn't say anything about causing others to judge themselves. And of course, this is what goes on in the novel. That what Clemence does is he talks to us, he convinces us of his own fraudulence and hypocrisy, and he forces us to examine ourselves and our lives and our actions, and ask whether we might not be self-deceptively guilty of exactly the same kind of fraud and hypocrisy. He doesn't judge us, but his confession is, in fact, is a way of manipulating us into judging ourselves and undermining ourselves. And so, perhaps he doesn't judge us. Nevertheless, it has the same effect. In fact, it has a more serious effect, because we undermine ourselves that, unlike Clemence himself, we no longer feel as if we know what to do. The Christian symbolism here has another sense too. It goes back to our discussion of the stranger, and at the end of that novel, the idea of Meursault being put through the trial as a way of making him feel guilty, of making him come to the realization that insofar as he understands his life, he must understand that he's guilty. And I commented very briefly that this had something to do with the notion of original sin, even though Camus himself, of course, was an atheist. It has to do with original sin if you think again about how we all find ourselves, when we think about it, in a world in which we're actually pretty privileged, a world in which we are surrounded by suffering, a world in which we're surrounded by injustice. And to be aware of that is to make us feel we should do something about it. It's also to make us aware that there is so much suffering and injustice that we ourselves couldn't possibly do enough. There are a number of solutions to this. One is Mother Teresa's, which I think is always a very significant one. She said in an interview before her death, "I never think except in terms of the one person I'm dealing with at the time." When she was asked about how do you cope with the millions and millions of suffering and dying people in India, that was her answer. One can also simply turn away. It's what I sometimes call the drop in the bucket syndrome. Why should I give to this charity? There are a million children starving in West Africa right now. What difference is my $5, $10, $100, even $1,000 going to do? And unless you can think of saving one child or one family, that kind of despair is going to lead you to simply turn away. What Camus means by original sin, in fact, has no religious overtones. It has nothing to do with Adam and Eve. It has to do with the fact that insofar as we are reflective, we are aware of the evil, the inequities of the world, and we too are confused about what to do about it. And if we're fully human, we will feel, in the appropriate sense, guilty. This is what Clemence, interestingly enough, doesn't allow himself to feel. But instead of this being a recipe or a recommendation for Christianity, I would say it is part of Camus' condemnation. Because what you get in Clemence is a kind of pride which is very easily conflated with Christian self-righteousness. It's the idea that I have admitted to you, I have confessed, and I have made it clear that I do not think of myself as anything but dirt. It's the ultimate in humility. But in that humility is a self-righteousness, which in many ways is much more destructive. And of course, Clemence, while he does some lawyering, in a way some good deeds while he's in Amsterdam, nevertheless, in a way, kind of writes off the universe in a way that Camus himself never did. Since it's his last novel, The Fall is often thought to be a kind of self-portrait. But the fact is, Camus died very suddenly and prematurely. He was killed in a car wreck in France. The car was driven by his publisher. He died almost instantly, but in any case, it's very clear that he didn't write The Fall with anything like the sense that it was his last work. What he did intend to do, according to a colleague of mine, Indian novelist named Raja Rao, who knew Camus quite well in Paris, he intended to go to India and study Indian philosophy. Now, it's a very interesting kind of question. Since the dichotomy, the opposition that we've been worried about throughout these past five lectures, has been the opposition between a kind of lived experience and a sense of reflection, and we've seen how, according to Camus, these things don't fit together very easily at all. It's a very interesting set of speculations about what he would have picked up if he had undertaken the study of Buddhism that he intended to undertake, what he would have come away with if he had come up with a different view of what reflection consists in. Because as I've been describing it, reflection is very much self-oriented. Reflection is very much in terms of thinking about your personal life. And at the same time, experience is your very personal experience. But of course, one of the main features of Buddhism is the fact that this whole notion of individuation, of your personal experience and reflection on your particular life starts breaking down. And the question that I always leave Camus with is the question, how do you reconcile reflection and experience? It seems to me that the dichotomy is much too harsh, as Camus himself certainly recognized, that we have very few experiences that really do count as pure experience. And there are very few bits of reflection which aren't reflections not only about, but reflections that are deeply involved in our experience. There's a sense in which there's a picture in Camus, comes out of the 18th century. It's something that I think dominated France for quite some time, but more interestingly, I think it still dominates America in a very powerful way. It's an image that comes from the French-Swiss philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He's the one who talked about what is often described as the noble savage. It's the idea that people are basically good inside, but society corrupts them. That as they become more sophisticated, as they become more articulate, as they learn the language of good and evil, they become a different kind of being, a superficial, vain, merely social being. And in Rousseau, the attempt is always to somehow try to recapture that inner goodness. And of course, the real challenge is to try and capture it in society itself and in politics, which is far beyond the scope of our study. But the image I want to highlight here is an image which looks something like this. In each of us, there is an innocent, good-natured person, and that is corrupted by society in such a way that we become vain, overly eloquent, overly concerned with status. It's not hard to see in this simple description the transition from Rousseau in The Stranger to Clemence in The Fall, that in Rousseau we have a character who has so far not been corrupted by society, and when society gets its hooks on him in the trial, he ultimately refuses to take on the role. Clemence, on the other hand, is very clearly a character who buys into the picture of increased eloquence, increased sophistication, increased nobility all the way. And as a result, he's utterly undone by it. The question I want to leave is simply, what do we do with this kind of sensibility, which divides the world so harshly into, on the one hand, experience, on the other, reflection? And when we turn to Kierkegaard, I hope to try and answer that question.